Working Cows Podcast, episode 224.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. This is Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network. And this episode is brought to you by Xyway brand fungicides by FMC. Very excited to be joined today by Eric Glenn. Eric is from the Colorado Cattlemen's Ag Land Trusts. Recently, we had a discussion with Margaret Byfield from American Stewards for Liberty about understanding 30 by 30 and got some feedback from that episode, encouraged me to seek out some other perspectives as well. And I'm always willing to do that as well. Happy to have a conversation with anybody who wants to give some other perspective. And Eric was the one suggested as somebody who could give some perspective on conservation easements and their place in agriculture. So Eric is from the Colorado Cattlemen's Ag Land Trust, so very qualified to talk about these things. And we're going to talk to him about some of the ins and outs and uses for conservation easements. So Eric, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Well, it's great to be here, and thanks for making time and having me on the podcast. A big fan, and appreciate all the work you do.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that very much. Yeah. So I guess I would like to talk today about conservation easements. We'll kind of make the positive case for conservation easements. You are with the Colorado Cattlemen's Ag Land Trust. Is that the right?
You got it. Name.
Okay. Got it. Okay. So, and that has, can you just tell us a little bit about the history of that organization and the work that you guys have been doing?
Sure. So the Colorado Cattlemen's Ag Land Trust has been around since 1995. We were established by the membership of the Colorado Cattlemen's Association, largely in response to some of the trends that were happening around estate tax issues and transition of farms and ranches in kind of the early and mid 90s. And really what the membership asked the Cattlemen's Association at that time was, you know, give us more tools to be able to keep these properties in families and keep family agriculture alive. And in Colorado and at that time and still today, you know, we had properties, farms and ranches near resort communities and along the Front Range, and where we were seeing significant development, and the values of those properties were just growing so much that there was no chance for folks to continue to take over and pass those properties on, or there was little chance. You were having to sell these legacy ranches or sell parts of them. And the member said, you know, there's a tool out there called a conservation easement that can help with that. Unfortunately, at that time, there wasn't really an organization that where farmers and ranchers could work with a conservation group that understood their business. And so they said, well, why don't we start our own and make sure that the folks that work there and that serve in the leadership of that organization understand what it takes to run a working farm and ranch. And so then this whole conversation started kind of happening in 1992, 1993. And then in 1995, the membership voted to establish the land trust. And we started April in 1995 and have grown, you know, kind of year after year, and continued to work on conserving these farms and ranches across the state. And you know, it's rewarding work, and it's rewarding to work with the families and to keep these properties in production agriculture and keep them in the family.
So how do these conservation easements help manage the tax burden. And I'm guessing that's a transition, you know, when there's a certain number of dollars in assets transitioned, then there comes an estate tax on that land. So how does a conservation easement help with that?
Yeah. And so in 1995, I think the estate tax exemptions were somewhere around $500,000 or $1 million. I mean, they were pretty low. Today they're $21 million, I think, combined. So we don't see easements used as much for the kind of traditional estate planning today as we used to. But the way they work is that they do devalue the property. So you're putting restrictions on the property that property has to remain in an open state, meaning that it can continue to be used for farming or ranching operations, but you can't sell off smaller chunks for development. You can't turn it into a subdivision. You can't do those things. It's got to stay as a single unit. And by doing that, you are devaluing the property in theory, right? There's fewer people that can buy larger properties. There's fewer people that want to be in production agriculture. You know, you can make more money subdividing than you can in building houses than you can in agriculture. And so it devalues the property. And by devaluing the property, you can bring that estate tax burden down. And that's what folks were doing in the kind of mid-90s, all the way through when I started here in kind of 2008. A lot of the work we did was around estate planning and trying to bring property values down in such a way that you could actually allow that next generation an opportunity to afford the estate taxes, or maybe not even have to pay estate taxes at all and keep that property in agriculture, keep that property in the family. Today we see people using it for a lot of different reasons. There's still some that are using it for estate tax planning purposes, but primarily what we're seeing people use them today for is expansion. We work with a lot of families that are looking to find ways to expand their operation. Part of that is because they got kids on the ranch that they may need more land to make that operation more economically viable to support two or three families. And we can use conservation easements as a tool to help people expand. And the way we do that is if a conservation easement is purchased through what we call bargain sale conservation easement transaction, those funds that are used to purchase the easement can actually be used as 1031 exchange. So you don't have to sell a parcel. You're selling an easement and then you're 1031 eligible into another property. So we've worked with a number of landowners on that strategy to expand. We also see landowners using this as a way to pay down debt. We also see them looking at ways to generate income off of that property to then diversify revenue streams in different ways. So we've had landowners do easements and then they don't necessarily 1031 into another farm and ranch operation. One family we worked with 1031 into an apartment complex in a college town where their son happened to be going to college. And that gave them some additional revenue streams that were coming in to support the operation when, you know, the markets were down or all the things that we have to deal with and face in agriculture. You know, having a different source of income that's not necessarily farm or ranch based is pretty helpful and crucial, I think, these days for ag families.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I've always wondered in this conservation easement discussion, I've been exposed to. I was actually in the delegate session of South Dakota Farm Bureau when the delegates of South Dakota Farm Bureau voted to move forward as a founding member of the South Dakota Ag Land Trust. And so I've kind of been familiar with it over the last few years. And then my own family, not me and my wife, but my family have kicked around the idea of getting involved in that with some of the land that they've got around the Black Hills. And so, you know, I've been involved with it on many different sides. And one of the things I've always wondered about is, you know, that development revenue is a one-time deal. So how long does it take for production agriculture to eclipse what that development revenue creates on that first sale? You know, I mean, it doesn't seem like it would take all that long, really, for, especially when you start talking about generations and some of these ranches, you know, 6-7 generations in, you know, it doesn't seem like it would take that long for the productivity of that land to eclipse the one-time development opportunity.
Yeah, and I think we've got work to do in the conservation world. One of the challenges I think conservation easements have is that they are that one-time tool, right? That you convey the easement and you capture all of the incentives, and then your kids or your grandkids are still there working the land and facing some of the same issues. And they've had one of the tools taken away from them in the easement, but two, they've also haven't taken away from them the ability to potentially sell smaller parcels or do other things, right? Because the easement's there. And so what we need to be working on in conservation, and this is something we are constantly talking about at Colorado Cattlemen's and in the other ag land trust or organizations across the West and Midwest, is how do we continue to support that next generation farmer or rancher? And what we need to be talking about is layering tools on top of easements. Are there ways in which we can, because a family has taken a commitment and said, we're committed to agriculture, we've conserved this land, it's always going to be there for production agriculture. That's a big commitment. It says something about them. And so what we need to be doing is finding tools to build upon that easement where we can compensate landowners for doing other things that they're, quite frankly, Clay, that they're already doing. I mean, I think you and I both know that the product that ag producers sell is only a small fraction of the value that they provide back to the public, right? We do, ag producers do so much more that they don't get compensated for that the public gets to benefit from. So how can we find ways through conservation and through other mechanisms to compensate landowners for the other things that they're already doing that they've never been compensated for in the past? And one of the reasons that we think conservation easements can play a big role in that is it provides durability, meaning we know that those lands will always be there to continue to produce those things that the public values. There's no fear that if we continue to invest in those lands, that at some point in the future, they're not going to be there. And instead, they're going to be, a subdivision, or they're going to be a strip mall, or whatever that may be. And so that's where we're going, and that's where this needs to go. And I always relate this back to, I have two staff members who their families did conservation easements on their ranches in the kind of mid-2000s, with the whole intent to be able to transition that property onto their daughters, who now work here for Colorado Cattlemen's. And what I've said is, that works, but for Maggie and Molly, or maybe it's not for them, but for their grandkids, for their kids, they're going to face similar issues as their parents did. And we've got to find ways to solve those issues, or at least provide them with tools to solve those issues, right? I don't want to say conservation easements are for everybody. I don't think they are. That's really critical, that this is something that people need to understand is a big decision. It's a decision that shouldn't be taken lightly. It's a decision that should involve the entire family. And the other thing I would say is, you got to find the right partner too. And I think that's the biggest thing I would say to producers who are thinking about conservation easements. You got to find the right partner. And if you're an ag producer, find a partner who understands agriculture.
Yeah. So I guess I do feel like we need to maybe address some of the questions or objections to conservation easements as part of this discussion. And so I guess maybe probably the biggest one, at least, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm guessing the biggest one is that why perpetual? Was there a reason for starting there? Just why perpetual, I guess?
Well, I think really the answer to that is this concept of durability. Let's take Colorado, for example. And Colorado is changing quickly. You know, the growth in this state is significant. If we don't have tools where we can create some certainty around the scale of agriculture in areas where agriculture is productive in this state. And by that, I mean, if you look at a soils map of the state of Colorado, some of our best soils are right where all the development's happening. Mm. And so if you think about some of the objections to farming and ranching that you hear is, you know, more inputs needed. You know, you're having a bigger impact on the climate or whatever. Well, part of that is just, I think, poor planning by society of saying we're going to take the most productive soils out of production. We're going to turn them into cities or towns or whatever, you know, it is. And then we're going to move agriculture off to more marginal ground where we need to do more. And the funny thing is right, as agricultural producers, we want to be the best stewards of that land. And so we're doing everything we can to get that soil into a better, more healthy place. And so, you know, for us, when we think about it, it's about making sure that we have quality agricultural lands for the future. Because if we don't, I think we all should be fearful of, for a long time, we were net energy importers, right? And that caused us a lot of problems. If we have to be net food importers, that's going to create a whole level higher set of problems than we can ever imagine. And so, yeah, again, conservation easements, perpetual conservation easements, not for everybody, but one of the value of perpetual conservation easements is you have that certainty that land's going to be there. It can be used for production agriculture in the future.
Sure.
And I might address, you know, one of the comments that was made in a previous episode was that, you know, if you do a conservation easement, you basically lock in place that the farming methods that you're doing today. And that's just not accurate. And I can tell you, as somebody who's put, you know, 100 of these together, that the whole goal is to make sure that they're adaptable to future, to the future, and to allow producers to continue to be economically viable. It would be silly for us to say, well, you know, you're growing dryland wheat today, and 100 years from now, you got to grow dryland wheat on that same amount of acres. That just doesn't work. You know, some of these properties that are farmed may be better go back to grazing lands, right? And there's nothing in an easement. Now, let me temper that. There's nothing in an easement with an agricultural land trust that you're ever going to see that would lock you into a specific method of agriculture. And there's nothing that would lock you into, oh, you can't move that fence, you can't put a fence in, you can't take a fence down. You know, what we want to do is make sure that producers can manage the way they know best. Our goal with the easement is to simply say this property is important for the future, for ag productivity, for any number of reasons. And this landowner came to us voluntarily and said, I'm willing to do this. And so what we have to do is find the way to craft the easement to say the property itself will always be there to grow food and fiber and energy for this country. What that looks like in the future, we don't know. And so we need to give that management flexibility to the producer. And I think you and I can both agree, my family farmed in Nebraska and we ranch in Colorado. We know that operation. If I were to come up to South Dakota and try to say, well, you know, what I know in Nebraska or Colorado, and so we're going to apply it here, doesn't necessarily work in South Dakota. And so our approach is really, you got to let the producer make those decisions because they're the best land manager.
Is it locked into certain kinds of development, or does it preclude somebody from doing, you know, like a wind farm or mineral rights or any of those things, accessing mineral rights? How are they generally structured in that regard?
Good question. So, you know, we're trying to limit infrastructure development on the property outside of ag infrastructure, right? So what an easement will typically do is define certain areas on the property where you can build major infrastructure, barns, riding arenas, houses, that stuff will be defined in the easement, that those structures can be placed in these areas on the property. And in an ag easement, you're not going to have any limitations on your ag infrastructure. You'll have some limitations on residential infrastructure, but those are all negotiated, right? And it's what works for that family. Outside of those areas, then what you're trying to do is maintain the functionality of that operation and that landscape. And so you don't want major infrastructure going outside of those building envelopes. Now, that doesn't mean you can't build and install windmills and solar panels and stock tanks and corrals and all the thing that we need to make a operation functional. Now, to your question about like wind farms, currently under the guidance from the Internal Revenue Service, which is where kind of the easement law at a federal level lives, is that commercial wind and solar are not compatible with conservation easements. And what that means is that you can't claim a federal tax deduction for an easement that would be placed over a property that was allowing or had commercial wind or solar. It doesn't mean that you could not have a conservation easement. It just means you're not going to be able to claim federal tax deductions for that. So what we're saying and how we're drafting deeds is, what happens in the future when technology changes such that commercial wind can be generated at a micro level? And I always use this example. What if you could put micro turbines on every fence post and generate commercial scale electricity? Is that impacting any conservation values? No. In fact, it probably is increasing conservation values in that, you know, raptors can't perch. And if you're in sage grouse territory, you know, you're helping that species out. So what we're saying is, you know, these are supposed to be perpetual documents. And whereas technology and legal limitations today say that this isn't allowed, what happens when those things change in the future? We can't lock a landowner in to say you can't participate in those things when these circumstances and criteria change. And so the way we try to draft the easement is to foresee those things, right? And say, if these things happen in the future, we can readdress that, as we should. And so that's where I think people get kind of hung up on this perpetuity thing, is that, you know, they think that it's just locking everything as is. Whereas if we're doing our jobs correctly, what we're trying to say is, these are the circumstances today. Circumstances may change in the future, and let's reassess those as those things happen. Because again, I think to say, you know, if you're generating commercial grade energy from a wind turbine that sits on the top of a fence post, you can't tell me that impacts conservation value. And we should be allowed to do that. To your question on minerals, surface mining is prohibited. And by surface mining, I mean like open pit coal mines. I think you could understand that, right? I mean, if you've got an open pit coal mine or an open pit copper mine, I mean, that's what it is. It's a mine, and those are pretty significant in size and scale. If we're talking about oil and gas that's being done, the extraction is subsurface, and now with our technology being such that you can drill one well per 640 acres, and it might be even more than that today, what easements do and how they handle subsurface extraction, as they say, it's limited, localized, and not irremediably destructive of the conservation values. So we have plenty of easements whereby we have wells on those easements. But and what I think you would hear from the landowners that we've worked with is that what ends up happening is that the siting ends up being better because we push on the operator of that's installing those to be a little bit more mindful of, you know, let's not put the well in the middle of the alfalfa field. You know, and if you leave it up to them, they're just going to drill wherever they want, right? And so what we try to do is be a partner with our landowners and say, how can we help and use the easement and the requirements under law that these, you know, have to be limited and localized to better site, not to preclude you from taking advantage of mineral resources under your property unless you choose to do that, right? But in most instances, and why, you know, it's treated that way is in a lot of cases in the West, the mineral estate's severed from the surface estate and the mineral estate's dominant. We can't come in and use an easement to tell a dominant estate owner that they can't drill well on that property. What we can do is sit down with them and do a better siting plan when it needs to happen.
Sure. Well, and I think that, you know, like you mentioned with directional drilling technology, you could probably drill on a portion of it that wasn't in an easement and directionally still extract that, you know, oil and gas that was under the land that was on an easement even, you know, I'm guessing. So some of that stuff can be one solution. Are these one size fits all? I mean, you basically have one document in the file and you pull it out and say, we're going to put these sections in an easement sign here, or can they be tailored to each ranch's individual concerns and desires for the future?
Yeah. So everyone's tailored specifically to that operation and that property. And I think one of the things that I'm most proud of with our organization and I know the other ag land trusts like South Dakota Ag Land Trust do the same is each year we look at that document. At least the starting point of the document. So we do have a template where we start from and then we negotiate to the specifics of the property. We look at that each year and we bring in producers and we listen to our landowners that we're working with and we say, what's working, what's not? How do we make this better from a starting point? And so that is something that's really critical of the process is that the starting easement, the starting point of the easement is set up in a way that kind of generally works from an agricultural producer standpoint. But then when we get into that specific property, then we're working with that specific landowner saying, what do you need? What does your operation look like? And then we make adjustments to that template easement to reflect the management specifications of that individual property, what that landowner needs, what his family needs in the future. And that's where, you know, I think when you talk to folks who've had good experiences with easements, it's a collaborative process of saying, this is why we want to do this. This is where we want to go with it. How do we get there? And we all collectively sit down and find a path forward to achieve those goals. And again, nobody's, I think one of the myths out there is that there's some grand conspiracy to force landowners to do conservation easements. And these are all voluntary, right? I mean, to the point where somebody who's working with Colorado Cattlemen's Ag Land Trust, we're not even allowed to solicit for easements. Landowners have to call us. They have to invite us to their property to have a discussion. And the process takes most easements that I've worked on, from the time that we're contacted to the time we complete them, you know, you're talking 2-3 years, because it's a big decision. And we want to make sure that it's a decision that those landowners are making and they feel comfortable with, and that their families feel comfortable with. At the end of the day, Clay, I tell you, if we never did another easement, I'd be okay with that, because it needs to be driven by the landowner, right? And so if landowner said, we don't want to do these anymore, that's fine. That's great. If landowners continue to say, we want to do these, which is what we see, we need to find groups like Colorado Cattlemen's Ag Land Trust, South Dakota Ag Land Trust, that understand producers and will advocate for the producers and will draft easements that work for production agriculture now and in the future. And just as an aside to that, when we were working on the South Dakota Ag Land Trust feasibility study, one of the reasons that South Dakota Cattlemen's and I think South Dakota Farm Bureau eventually kind of said, we want to do this, is because so many of their members were asking for conservation easements. And they were being forced to work with other groups that weren't in their mission directly tied to production agriculture. And my argument was, why are we forcing our members to work with groups whose main focus is not the preservation of production agriculture in this country? Our groups, groups founded by these ag industry groups, our main objective is ensuring that production agriculture continues to exist. All the other things we talk about, species, open space, any other conservation values, those are byproducts of well-managed agricultural operations, right? And that's where I think conservation group as a movement has always got it wrong. What we should be focusing, or what it as a movement should have been focusing on, was supporting those ag producers and saying, you are the reason why we have all these great resources, then we want to protect that land in the first place. So we've got to find a way to continue to allow you to do that. I just found it funny that, you know, conservation groups, they say, some conservation groups say, well, we want to conserve that land, but then we want the landowner to change their management. I'm like, well, why would you want to conserve? Why do you want to conserve it? You want to conserve it because they're doing a great job managing it today. So our argument is set up conservation groups that are tied to agriculture who understand it's the landowner who's the great steward that's doing the great job keeping those, keeping that wildlife habitat there, continuing to grow food and fiber and energy that we all need as a society. And then we all, you know, anybody in the public that drives through the Black Hills or through, you know, around Pierre or other parts in South Dakota or through Colorado, you know, the places they most remember from a scenic standpoint are these farms and ranches.
Yeah. Well, and you look at the list of founding partners for the South Dakota Ag Land Trust, South Dakota Cattlemen, South Dakota Conservation Districts, South Dakota Grassland Coalition, and the South Dakota Farm Bureau. Those are all organizations, you know, that I think have the best interests of South Dakota farmers and ranchers in mind for the most part. And I think that, sometimes those other conservation organizations and going to them and working with them on a conservation easement can sometimes feel a little bit like letting the fox guard the hen house. And it kind of gets a little worrisome as far as, you know, what are their motivations in the end and and what happens when the motivations of that organization change because new people come in to control. So I really have always appreciated, you know, that's been some of my favorite parts of being involved in Farm Bureau is their emphasis on volunteerism and property rights and protecting those things. And, trying to make, I always tongue in cheek describe, Farm Bureau as a self-defense organization for ranchers, you know, farmers and ranchers. And so, so I think they're a powerful groups and powerful tools. And, it's good to have them involved, you know, kind of back to what you were saying about forcing people to go and solicit, help for an easement from organizations that maybe don't have quite the great track record as far as defending agriculture is concerned. I wanted to move on to threatened land. How is that defined? And for example, right here where I'm sitting at my office, I'm 35 miles from a gas station. I am 90 miles. I know I'm 90 miles from the nearest Walmart. I'm out here. I'm probably not going to be a prime candidate for an ag land trust conservation easement. But can you talk a little bit about how you define threatened land?
Yeah, and we try to avoid that term, Clay. So I think it kind of corrupts what we're doing. So, you know, what people want to say conservation easements are about is eliminating development. What I argue is what it's really about is conserving things that we need as a society to be healthy and to ensure that we can continue to be a net exporter of food. So when I look at conservation, particularly from an ag standpoint, it's saying every property out there, is a candidate if a landowner wants to do it, because we don't know what's going to happen 100, 200 years from now. And if a landowner sees value in saying this property should be in place to grow food, to provide energy, to do all those things that farms and ranches do, we should be able to work with them to ensure that property can exist. Because there's probably many places that you drove when you were a kid that were farm and ranch land that now today, and as a kid, you probably were like, man, nobody will ever want to be there. And today, it's something different. I think if we're going to continue to ensure that particularly that family agriculture can continue to exist in this country, we need more land, right? And the other thing that I find funny is that, you know, the consumer continues to say, we want more grass-fed. Let's just talk about grass-finished beef, right? Well, you need a lot more land to have grass-finished beef, right? And at the same time, what we're seeing is more and more conversion of land out of agriculture. So how do you square those two things? So what I really try to talk about instead of threatened lands is we got to conserve things that are important to the future of society and the health of society and the health of agriculture. And again, all of this needs to be voluntary, right? I mean, that's to me the biggest takeaway in this is that if it's ever forced on somebody, then it's the wrong thing. But I want places for my kids to be able to experience the things that I was able to experience as a kid. And I think we all want to do that. And conservation easements can be a tool to do that, and not just around cities or around urban areas. And one of the pressures we see for producers in Colorado is absentee landowners coming in, buying properties for recreational purposes, right? And it's a lot of it's around hunting. And in some instances, you know, they don't want people grazing cattle on that because it's disrupting. They think it's disrupting wildlife or whatever. And so we're seeing, you know, these traditional family ranches in certain parts of the state, you know, they're sold and then they're not being developed in this traditional sense that we think about, but they're being converted into these kind of recreational havens for people that are out of state that just want to come in two times a year to hunt. And, you know, I'm never going to tell somebody that they shouldn't do something that they want to with their land, right? I mean, that's private property. We need to uphold that principle. Couldn't agree more with that. But I think, you know, this tool of a conservation easement is just that. It's a tool. And the one thing I don't want to have happen is take more tools away from agricultural producers to find a way to continue to do what they want to do on their land and probably what their kids and grandkids want to do.
Yeah. And how are they funded? Where's the money coming from? I mean, there's a pretty good capital outlay there to purchase the land for the conservation easement. Then it can be 1031 exchanged into another investment, whether that's an apartment complex or expanding the ranch or whatever. So where's the money coming from? How are they funded?
Yeah. So there's a number of different sources. Probably the biggest source across the country is USDA through Farm Bureau or Farm Bill, not Farm Bureau, sorry, through the Farm Bill. There's a number of easement programs under the Farm Bill. The one that is mostly used for perpetual easements is called the Agricultural Conservation Easement Program, ACEP. That's a big funding source. And again, we have this conversation every single day because what we do when we're working with the landowner is we sit down and we say, here are the funding options that are available. Which ones are you willing to work with? Because there are some people that don't want to work with the federal government. And I get that, right? And we're not going to force somebody to do that. But it is a big funding source. And we work pretty hard to try to make that funding source work better for ag producers in each iteration of the Farm Bill. Other sources include state programs. In Colorado, Colorado Parks and Wildlife will fund conservation easements. Again, you know, they're going to want certain things, right? That's the thing that people need to understand is that anytime you engage a funder, that funder is going to want something. And so understanding what that funder wants is really important. And that's the job of the land trust partner with the landowner, make sure that that landowner fully understands all those things going into this so that they can choose wisely for their operational needs. So you got these state funding programs, you got federal funding programs, and you got a lot of private funders out there, foundations, charitable foundations that are interested in this. But primarily, I still think this is true. The primary source of conservation easement incentives is the federal tax deduction and the estate tax deduction. Vast majority of easements across the country are still just being conveyed for that federal tax piece. And I would say that because, you know, I would say the agricultural conservation easements are not the majority of easements being conveyed in the country. So in the West, that whole concept's different, right? Most of our agricultural easements, you know, we are using that federal tax deduction and that estate tax provision in combination with some of these funding sources.
And is that tax deduction, the federal tax deduction, is that the 1031 exchange on the sale of the land or is that something else?
Something different. So the 1031 only exchange provisions only apply if we are using funds from like NRCS or a state funding program to purchase that easement. What most landowners are doing is simply what we call donating the easement. So they're not getting any cash compensation in return for the easement. Instead, what they're getting is a pretty significant federal tax deduction. That has a pretty significant carry forward, and an estate, and you get an extra $500,000 estate tax exemption. So you're devaluing the property. So let's say, you know, you have a a ranch outside of Steamboat Springs in Colorado. And that ranch been in your family for 150 years, and it's now worth $21 million. And you put an easement on it, you can bring that property down, let's say, to $11 million. And then you're getting an extra $500,000 on top of that in additional estate tax exemption. And let's say, you know, you had other income coming in from hunting, you know, you were leasing your property out to big game hunters who were coming in, and you were doing pretty well with it. And you had a bigger federal tax liability than just an average producer. Well, you can offset that federal tax liability with that federal deduction that comes from that easement.
Sure.
I'm getting pretty into the weeds here. So
That's all right. I try not to glaze over. And I think that other people, you know, listening to this are looking for a little bit more than just the 5 minute, radio clip that we would get. So we're trying to get some detail and find some, find out, you know, just how this works and who it works for and some of those things. So, you know, I guess, you know, the elephant in the room or whatever is the federal government. And I do want to address some of those things, you know, and I guess we'll just, the best way to do it is just to address it head on. Is 30 by 30 a concern? Is the America the Beautiful, is that agenda a concern? Are these conservation easements in any way connected to that, or are those things misunderstood, misrepresented? You know, I guess if you want to talk to some of those things, I would entertain that.
Sure. So I think,
and if you don't, I can edit that question out.
No. You know, I think the simple answer is that nobody knows yet, and that's so that does cause concern, right? I think there could be really good positive things for agriculture that come out of the America the Beautiful if the administration wants to take the principles that we advocate for, which is everything has to be voluntary. Understand that the producer has the best interest of the land in his best mind. Let him or her manage that property the way they want to do it, because if they don't, I mean, they're not going to be economically profitable, right? I mean, that's the funny thing is that if you abuse the land, you're not going to be economically profitable. And so, you know, if there's a way to funnel more money towards conservation of ag lands through America the Beautiful in a way that doesn't get in the way of the producer, that could be very positive. But we don't know what that's going to look like yet. You know, I was on a call yesterday with some folks from USDA and Department of Interior, where they're saying the right things. They're saying, we want this to be locally driven. We want to focus on making sure that working lands that participate in something around this can continue to be sustainable and continue to work. But the proof's going to be in how they implement it, right? But at the end of the day, I always go back to, if you're a producer, there's never going to be an obligation for you to do an easement. You don't ever have to do that. So, you know, what you got to do is say, what's right for me and my family? And if conservation is something that a producer wants to look at, in 30 by 30 or America the Beautiful has new funding programs, or they put more money into existing funding programs that you're interested in looking at and considering, you know, you got to consider it. You got to take the time, right? Do the research and talk to a number of people, and then make sure you're choosing the right partner. Again, I just think, and I've kind of said to NCBA and Farm Bureau both, I said, you know, if you've got other states that don't have ag land trusts associated with your state affiliates, but you got members that continue to say they want conservation easements, I don't think we're serving those members well, or as well as we can. I don't want to say we're not serving them well, right? But if I think there was some like 1,700 producers in South Dakota were looking for conservation easement opportunities. That's a big number. And I think what we need to do is make sure we're creating organizations that have the best interest of those groups and can also push back on those federal partners and hold them accountable. That's we spend a lot of time in DC making sure, you know, that Congress, that the agencies, everybody understands what our producers are facing and how we can best support them. And making sure that we're developing conservation programs that work for them. That's what we need to do.
Yeah, I'm looking at the press release here. You know, Biden-Harris administration outlines the America the Beautiful initiative. And as you said, the byline says the right things. Initial report details vision for 10-year locally led and voluntary nationwide effort to restore and conserve America's lands, waters, and wildlife. Now, the concern comes that they will confuse the terms conserve and preserve, but ultimately, whether or not they get away with doing that would be up to the people to hold them accountable to, you know, you said conserve, not preserve. Let's you know, stay on the right track here. And it ultimately, you know, our government gets away with what we let them get away with. You know, there are mechanisms in place for us to push back, and so it isn't always going to be a hands off approach. Isn't always going to be an option. We've got to take some of those mechanisms and put them into practice if we're gonna hold them to the agreements that we had with them. You know, and you know, the contract you sign is only as good as the partners who are a part of it, but you've got to recognize that and make sure that they all fulfill their parts of that contract. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I think what we can't do is folks that work in production agriculture, either directly or in some sort of supporting fashion, we can't bury our heads in the sand, right? We got to be willing to go to DC, we got to be willing to go to the state house, and we got to talk to those that are making legislation and making policy and share with them in a way that is persuasive. We've got to do a better job, I think, being persuasive. And that's where, you know, groups like NCBA, Farm Bureau, I think, you know, that's the meat and potatoes of what they do, and it's important, but they are only as good as the members who engage, right, and direct those organizations on what the policies initiatives need to be. And so the more people we can get involved in our industry associations and that are willing to go and engage and go to DC or go down to the state capitol and tell the story, we're going to be a lot better off, because the work farmers and ranchers, you know, the work they do, the things they provide to the public are so critical and so important and so overlooked oftentimes by society, and they impact every level of society. And we just haven't done as good of a job of telling that story and relating it to people as we need to. And I think, you know, we got to double down and do more of it.
Yeah. And, you know, that to borrow a phrase from the president of American Farm Bureau, Zippy Duval, he says, if you're not at the table, you're going to be on the menu, you know. And so we need to make sure that we're staying involved in these conversations. And I think that South Dakota Farm Bureau, for sure, I have seen the grassroots nature of that organization work, where if you're willing to get involved and show up to meetings and show up to the delegate sessions, you can pass resolutions that are somewhat transformative to, you know, to that organization, and even resolutions that don't necessarily fall in line with the national party line of those organizations. And I think that's as it should be, that the South Dakota Farm Bureau should be representative of the concerns of South Dakota farmers and ranchers, you know, and the complexity of these big national organizations is trying to make
the national organization representative of the concerns of all of the people they represent, but it's a grassroots organization at its heart, and it only is going to reflect the people who are involved. And if people don't get involved, then it's going to continue to not reflect their concerns. So I guess that's kind of my soapbox. But it's an important process. And I guess any major nuggets that we left on the table today, anything else that you wanted to cover as far as conservation and easements are concerned?
Maybe the one other thing I would just add, Clay, is that I also serve as the president of the Partnership of Rangeland Trusts, and which is known as PORT. And we have 9 members that operate in 11 states across the West and Midwest. South Dakota Ag Land Trust is the newest member. We have member organizations in Texas, Kansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, California, and then a Northwest group that operates in Oregon, Idaho, and Washington. And as PORT members, we all have to adopt a set of principles that talk about how we approach conservation. And we also all have to be affiliated with either a statewide livestock group or a statewide farm group. And we have to have our leadership has to come from producers. We require that our boards are made up of producers, because that's how, again, going back to your soapbox, you know, the way we make these things work is we get involved and we make them work for the people we need to serve. PORT's a great organization and is really focused on advocating to make sure that conservation works for producers in the West and in the Midwest. And I think the other thing we're seeing is that we're being effective at changing the dynamics of conservation in general. You know, the Nature Conservancy is kind of changing the way it thinks about conservation to be much more amenable to agriculture. You know, they're never going to have their prime focus be preservation, conservation of ag. But if we can make them better understand the importance of ag, it's going to make everything better, because at the end of the day, you know, we don't have PORT member groups in every state in the country, and we've got ag producers in every state in the country. And ag producers are going to continue to look at conservation easements, and they're going to have to find a partner. We need to make conservation groups understand agriculture better, and that's what we're trying to do.
Very good. Is there something I could throw on the show notes page, some resources that people could find? Today's episode show notes page will be workingcows.net/224, workingcows.net/224. If there's anything I can throw in the show notes page or ways people can get a hold of you, you can go ahead and share that.
Sure. Would be happy to. And again, thank you for your time and thanks for having me on, and enjoyed the conversation.
Go long for season-long foliar disease protection that starts at plant. Only Xyway brand fungicides from FMC provide season-long foliar disease protection from the start. Active ingredient flutriafol moves through your corn plants as they grow for inside-out protection from roots to tassel. Growers and retailers are sharing their Xyway brand fungicide success stories at xyway.ag.fmc.com. Always read and follow all label directions.
Very helpful stuff. Very much appreciate Eric taking the time to join me today. Hopefully there was some value there. Always encourage you, if you got questions about what you hear, don't hesitate. Drop me a line at workingcows.net/contact, and we will get you. We'll try to get all perspectives a chance to have some airtime. So I'm even open to hosting debates if that's what it takes. I think that's a better way to do it than just letting people say whatever they want without having giving somebody the ability to cross-examine. So even willing to do that going forward if that would be a good way to get both sides to have discussions. Very much looking forward to next week. Some of my favorite topics, genetics and finding grass-fed genetics or grass-finishing genetics. Bob Havard is starting a new project with the Nuffield Scholarship in the UK, and he's got quite a audacious goal of traveling even throughout America and Canada and finding some of these people who have been finding these genetics that really work in their environments to produce high-quality grass-finished beef. So very much looking forward to that. We'll see you again real soon with another episode of the Working Cows Podcast.
It changes everything. So says Indiana corn grower Nathan Davis about innovative Xyway LFR fungicide from FMC. Xyway brand fungicides are the first and only at-plant corn fungicides to provide unprecedented season-long inside-out foliar disease protection. Discover more grower and retailer success stories at xyway.ag.fmc.com. Always read and follow all label directions.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.